Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
I'm Sumi Somaskandar from the Global Story Podcast, where we're looking at the U.S. presidential debate, which much of the world was watching. Kamala Harris went up against Donald Trump in Philadelphia in the first face-off between the two ahead of November's election. What were the key takeaways? The Global Story brings you unique perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello and welcome to NewsHour from the BBC World Service. Coming to you live from London, I'm Nuala McGovern.
This is Jared now egressing through the forward hatch of Dragon Resilience. These are the first views of the first ever commercial spacewalk. I have a feeling the crowd is about to go wild.
Well, it was a long way to go to test a spacesuit and contact lenses, but what an image. Jared Isaacman, the American billionaire, emerging from the nose of a spacecraft into the vacuum of space, his luminous white spacesuit backdropped by Earth 700 kilometres away. And he was then followed by his mission specialist, Sarah Gillis, on the first ever privately funded spacewalks. The Polaris Dawn mission, it was funded by Isaacman, who is, as I mentioned, a billionaire. It blasted off in SpaceX Crew Dragon spacecraft. It had four non-professional astronauts on board. It still does. And it has broken so many barriers, not least taking humans further than any program since the Apollo missions in the 1970s. Looking forward to chatting with Professor Catherine Haymans, Astronomer Royal for Scotland. Good to have you with us, Professor.
Oh, hi, Nuala. I have had the best last few hours just watching this unfold. I mean, SpaceX sure know how to put on a show. They gave us full access to this spacewalk. You could see the astronauts inside the Dragon spacecraft, watching it depressurize, seeing Jared unlatch the hatch, and then eventually climb up and out into space. And the best thing, Nuala, was that there was a helmet camera inside his helmet, so you could see what he was seeing as he stepped out, and this beautiful vision of our planet Earth below him. It was just breathtaking. And my congratulations to the Polaris Dawn team and SpaceX. This is a major achievement.
You know, it was cinematic, wasn't it? And I was watching it and it took my breath away. And I was watching it kind of early on, you know, when it's very slow and they were like venting the cabin. We're all armchair astronauts now in the lingo. And each step took so long. But then all of a sudden it happened, this spacewalk, which is not a walk for those that weren't watching it. It's more like a pop out of the spacecraft attached by an umbilical white cord that remained within the spacecraft. But I mean, what does this mean? Why did people go so far in the 70s and then it's taken them until now to get back there?
Well, it's all a game of risk. I think back in the 70s, we were a lot happier taking risks with our astronauts. We've become a lot less risk averse. And so the furthest distance that most astronauts go these days is to the International Space Station. But Jared Isaacman, the commander of this mission and the billionaire entrepreneur who funded it, has got grand visions to get humans further into space, exploring the solar system. He's been quoted as saying that he wants to see an armada of ships arriving on Mars. And to do that, we need to work out how humans will cope in the radiation environment of space. So our planet Earth is protected by a fantastic magnetic field that protects us from these highly energetically charged particles that the sun emits. And this particular mission, Polaris Dawn, wanted to go really far out in our solar system to see how the human body responded to that radiation. And so there were 40 different experiments on board, really focused on human health. And then also they were testing out these brand new spacesuits that give the astronauts and much more flexibility. You said, Nuala, that it was very slow
watching
the astronauts move. But actually, that was incredibly flexible if you compare it to the bulky spacesuits that we see the NASA astronauts on the International Space Station using. Actually, the movement that I was seeing there in the astronauts, Jared and both Sarah, when they came out of the spacesuit, it was actually phenomenal to see that flexibility that's been allowed by SpaceX, completely redesigning the spacesuit from the ground up.
And also contact lenses. I mentioned them at the top. People are like, what? But they are going to actually check how space can affect, I suppose, when it comes to gravity, etc., the bodies of astronauts. Yeah. I should also mention they're four non-professional astronauts. I mean, that kind of blows my mind that they're up there.
So I think I would call them professional astronauts because they're up there and they've been training for 2 years. The difference here is that they are not government-employed, state-sponsored astronauts. And this is key. So a NASA astronaut is technically a federal employee. So there are certain levels of risk that they cannot take because they're a federal employee. And this mission was risky. I'm so relieved when the hatch latched again, it repressurized and those astronauts were safe back in their capsule, because the whole space capsule was opened up into space. There was no airlock. And so it was a very risky mission so far out in space with these brand new spacesuits. So I'm so delighted that it's gone successfully. And private citizens kind of needed to take that risk. These astronauts knew the risks that they were taking and were happy to take it to further Jared Isman and many other people's vision of getting humans further out into space. I think he's got a vision of colonising Mars. Whether it will ever happen is another question, because it's going to be hard.
Gender equality on that craft.
Very good. Yeah, no, I'm delighted to see equal two females, two males on the spacecraft. And that's exactly how it should be. Space is for everyone. Looking forward to the next step of the NASA Artemis program, where we'll see the first woman landing on the moon as well.
That's pretty cool. Do you think this will speed up the space race in my last 30 seconds or so, now that you have NASA or other state-sponsored space agencies coming up against the likes of SpaceX and other privately funded missions?
Yeah, no, the technology is moving at breakneck speed and NASA is working with these companies. You know, SpaceX currently takes NASA astronauts up to the International Space Station. Bit of a hiccup with the Boeing Starliner recently, which was the second option for NASA. But technology is really advancing incredibly quickly, which is exciting, but at the same time, slightly worrying, because we've got these private companies now going out into space. Is space going to become the playground of billionaires? I hope not. I hope they keep it open for us all.
You'll have to come back and we'll chat a bit more about that. Professor Catherine Haymans, the Astronomer Royal for Scotland. So great to speak with you. The family of the jailed Belarusian opposition leader Maria Kolesnikova say they fear she's been slowly killed in prison with insufficient food and extreme isolation. She's been held in solitary confinement for 18 months as extra punishment on top of an 11-year prison sentence for leading protests against Alexander Lukashenko in 2020. The news of the activist's plight came as the authoritarian leader of Belarus began a surprise release of other political prisoners, leading some to wonder whether he's signalling to Western governments that he wants to reduce his own political isolation. Our Eastern Europe correspondent Sarah Rainsford reports.
On March 10th, 2023, she was pushed in a punishment cell in total isolation.
Tatiana is desperately worried about her sister.
It's an even more horrible punishment cell.
Maria Kolesnikova was locked up for leading peaceful mass protests in Belarus in 2020. Crowds rallying against an election rigged to return Alexander Lukashenko to power. But the activist is being punished further in prison. Kept in isolation for 18 months now. No visits, no letters, no calls, and increasing concerns for her health.
What we hear, she's starving in the colony. Her illness requires a diet. She basically cannot eat what the food they provide in the colony. I believe that she already passed such a critical weight loss that endangers her life.
Tatiana compares her sister to Alexei Navalny. the Russian opposition activist who died suddenly in his Arctic prison.
International community didn't react in time for case of Navalny.
So you're asking the international community to pressure the Belarusian authorities to release Maria?
I think that any means should be used to help her, to save her, because her situation is critical.
Just walking through this pedestrian area of central Warsaw, and people in the coffee shops here, the vast majority of them are speaking Russian. A lot of them are from Belarus, people who have fled the political repression there under Alexander Lukashenko. A lot of them took part in those protests in 2020 and left, so they didn't get arrested.
For Dmitry Luksha, this city is now home. The journalist spent 28 months locked up. His only crime was to report on the opposition protests and then on his country's complicity in the war on Ukraine. In one prison camp, he worked breaking rocks alongside men convicted of murder and drug smuggling. But he tells me up to 30% of the inmates were there for their politics. You can spot them by the yellow tags they have stitched on their chests. This summer, though, Dmitry was suddenly pardoned by Alexander Lukashenko. He is one of about 80 political prisoners released so far in a series of surprise amnesties.
Maybe those who started the process, the arrests, realized they went too far. I don't know. But it's such a moment of joy to be home, to hug our families and to breathe freely again. The main thing is that this process is happening, and for it not to stop.
State media are presenting the pardons as proof of a caring, humane leader. There's another election due next year, so it is possible Lukashenko's looking to soften his image. Others think he's signalling to the West that he wants to engage. The chances of big-name prisoners like Maria Kolesnikova getting out look slim. But her sister saw Russia's big prisoner swap with Western countries last month, and that gave her some hope.
What we saw, like, you can negotiate during the war or Cold War, you can negotiate with people you name terrorists, yes, or dictators, and everything is possible.
Dmitry thinks about Maria Kolesnikova a lot. She became hugely popular during the 2020 protests. But Dmitry knows how in prison, political detainees are singled out for extra punishment. And even though he's out now, he admits he jumps at every noise. Terrified, the police are coming for him again to lock him up again. You understand that you've done nothing wrong and they shouldn't be coming for you. But you can't tell your heart that, Dmitry says. It is the brutal Belarus of today. And your heart is afraid.
That's our Eastern Europe correspondent, Sarah Rainsford, reporting. Coming up, actor Kate Winslet on Lee Miller, the subject of her latest film, a great war photographer, but was her later career overshadowed by her early career as a model and a muse to artists?
Lee was described in a sort of almost infantilizing way. And I thought, hang on a minute, hang on. That was a sliver of her life in her 20s. She lived a whole life way beyond that time. And she hated being a model. She always said, I'd rather take a picture than be one.
And headlines this hour, two civilian astronauts have tested a new generation of spacesuit in the first privately funded spacewalk. Jared Isaacman and Sarah Gillis spent about 15 minutes outside their Dragon spacecraft. This is Nuala McGovern with NewsHour Live from the BBC in London. The UN Secretary General has said that what he called dramatic violations of international humanitarian law must stop. Antonio Guterres' remarks came after six staff members of UNRWA, the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees, were killed in an Israeli airstrike on the Nuseirat refugee camp in central Gaza. The agency said the attack on the Al-Jauni school was the single deadliest for its staff since the Israel-Hamas war began 11 months ago. The Hamas-run government said at least 18 people were killed. Sam Rose is the Senior Deputy Director of UNRWA Affairs in Gaza, based in Khan Yunis, which is a short distance from the school. I asked him what was he hearing from his colleagues in Nuseirat.
They're describing shock, they're describing horror, just deeply, deeply troubled by what they've seen. That was yesterday as the incident was happening. And this morning, the staff have been getting back to work. And all this whilst the staff are themselves grieving because yet again, their colleagues have been killed. One was a shelter manager. The other staff are education staff, but who were working as coordinating mattresses, coordinating healthcare, coordinating sanitation and maintenance of the school or provision of social work or healthcare. This school in particular was sheltering about 12,000 people at the time of the incident.
The Israeli Defense Forces, the IDF, described the attack as a precise strike on terrorists who were operating inside a command and control center embedded within a compound that previously served as the Al-Jauni school. What would your response be to that?
Well, it's not the first time we've heard reports of precise munitions being used, but at the same time, it's not the first time that we've seen scores of civilian casualties as a result of such incident. It appears that heavy munitions were used in a heavily crowded area. And in circumstances like that, civilian loss of life is simply inevitable, as we've said countless times. But these warnings, these protests appear to be going unheeded because the attacks continue. We call on all parties to the conflict to respect the civilian nature of all our installations, protected humanitarian premises.
And you mentioned civilian nature of them. And so the IDF's description of the school as a command and control center that was embedded within it?
I mean, I can't confirm that. But what I can say is that there are rules of war, and this is why we call on all parties to the conflict to respect the character of these installations, and they should never be used for military or fighting purposes. That extends to Palestinian armed groups, including Hamas. It also extends to Israeli forces. There are rules of war. There are questions of proportionality, questions of precaution, questions of distinction that need to be adhered to. And it's why after there are incidents such as this, we always call for independent investigations to look into what happened.
We understand that it had been a so-called deconfliction with the IDF. Can you explain a little bit more what that word means and whether it was regarded to be a safe zone?
Absolutely. I mean, the coordinates of all our installations are shared with the Israeli authorities on a daily basis. Similarly, movements into areas where fighting is ongoing have to be coordinated. Many of these sites that have been hit are in areas that have been deemed by the Israeli authorities to be safe zones, similar to the incident we saw in Mawasi just a couple of nights ago. But this deconfliction process, which doesn't excuse the parties to the conflict to their obligations under international humanitarian law, simply appears not to be working. Just 2 days ago, we had a convoy that was headed north to support a polio vaccine campaign in northern Gaza. The movement was coordinated. The details of all the staff were shared with the Israeli authorities beforehand. That convoy was held up for hours. The staff were violently assaulted at gunpoint and put through the most horrific ordeals. So quite simply, the deconfliction doesn't appear to be working. The school that was hit yesterday, this time last week, was being used as a polio vaccination centre.
Sam Rose, Senior Deputy Director of UNRWA in Gaza. We did request an interview with the IDF, but they did not provide a representative. One of the most watched videos right now on the BBC News website is of American rock star Jon Bon Jovi and his colleague helping a distressed woman who was on the ledge of a bridge in Nashville, Tennessee on Tuesday night. The video was shared by the Metropolitan Nashville Police Department. You see the singer and his colleague slowly approaching a woman who had climbed over a barrier onto that ledge, and they gently persuade her to climb back over the railings, then hug her and walk her away from the edge. Bon Jovi and his team were reportedly filming a music video on that bridge at the time. Nikki Perfect is a former police negotiator who trains people in crisis communication. She joins me now. Good to have you with us, Nikki.
Hello, thank you very much for having me.
I thought this video made for quite extraordinary viewing. It's obviously this very precarious situation, and I felt like each move by Jon Bon Jovi, or indeed his colleague, who I can't find her name, I have looked in newspapers because she was very much involved as well, could have an impact on this distressed woman. What did you think when seeing it?
Yeah, and it's a lovely video to watch, and it's very interesting. There's a couple of things that really interest me in how they approached her. You'll notice that the female puts the her whatever she has in her hands down, and then moves towards the woman who is on the wrong side of the railings, or what I would call the wrong side of the railings. Mm-hmm. And Bon Jovi, he goes to the railings and just keeps a little way back. But if you watch, she turns and she can see that he's there. So he already has her attention, which is always good in a negotiation around somebody on the wrong side of the railing. So yeah, I found that fascinating.
I found his body language fascinating, Jon Bon Jovi's. He was so relaxed. He kind of casually leaned over as if they were just chatting about something, very humdrum every day, instead of this precarious, as I described it, situation. And I was wondering, you know, for the average person, we're not equipped to deal with these situations. You obviously are. What do you think needs to come into moments like this for them to turn out well?
Yeah, and that's a lovely question, because people often say to me, you know, I don't want to get it wrong. I don't want to say the wrong thing. I'm not sure what I would do myself in that situation. And we find really that just sharing some kindness and stopping and asking somebody if they are okay is the most simple form of human connection, and is very powerful and makes a real difference, especially if somebody is in a crisis like this lady seems to be, standing on that wrong side. But just saying to somebody, are you okay? Or saying what you see, like, I notice you're standing on the wrong side of the railings. You seem a bit distressed. How can I help you? Just having those words with somebody helps them to change their focus a little bit, and helps them to re-engage, and perhaps might even, if they're thinking that nobody cares about me, I'm all alone in the world, that might just have a bit of a connection with them. And they go, well, actually, here's some evidence that somebody does care about me, because they stopped to talk to me.
Is that the common thread, do you think, in situations you've been in?
Definitely kindness and empathy and listening without judgment, and that don't try and solve my problem for me. Just hear me and hear what I've got to say is hugely powerful. And I've witnessed that in many cases where people have been in crisis.
The woman did touch the distressed woman briefly, which was a brave move in some ways. It worked in this instance.
Yes, it did. And that's interesting you notice that as well. I watched it, and I watched her approach, and I noticed that the woman had turned to see her.
Yes.
And I think that's really key there, the fact that she was already seen, because I feel that if the lady had still been looking out and you'd have touched her, that might have made her jump a bit, or made her a bit nervous.
So there was a connection. Nikki Perfect, good to speak to you, former police negotiator. Thanks very much.
I'm Sumi Somaskandar from the Global Story Podcast, where we're looking at the U.S. presidential debate, which much of the world was watching. Kamala Harris went up against Donald Trump in Philadelphia in the first face-off between the two ahead of November's election. What were the key takeaways? The Global Story brings you unique perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to NewsHour. In Malawi, extreme weather patterns are pushing farmers to experiment with new ways to use their harvest. Some of them are now turning to overripe bananas that would otherwise go to waste into something perhaps unexpected, wine. Anna Kumu reports.
Emily is clearing weed from her once thriving banana plantation. A severe heat wave has turned most of her harvest into scorched soil and dried up leaves.
It is sad that we have to go through all this waste. The heat here is unbearable. All our hard work and investment is lost.
Extreme weather events in Karonga District, northern Malawi, have become more frequent. Farmers here face a challenging mix of harsh heat and intense rain. Emily relocated her farm from the shores of Lake Malawi to higher grounds to protect her land from flooding. But now, searing temperatures have made farming nearly impossible.
Some of the bananas fell off their branches. Some you can't even see where we planted. Down at the old farm, our challenge was loads of water from the lake. Up here, we have way too much heat from the sun. All this makes our bananas ripen very fast and go to waste.
So instead of throwing away overripe bananas, Emily and her colleagues have put them to better use. They use overripe bananas to make wine. Bananas are selected, peeled, sweetened and doused in yeast and lemons to preserve taste. They are then fermented to make wine. Tennyson Gondwe is the CEO of Comsip Cooperative Union, which has been helping women venture into this business.
There was quite a lot of problems for the farmers to transition from banana as a subsistence crop to wine making. To maintain quality and taste of the banana wine, that's why we are saying we have invested very much in capacity building to train them on how to have quality production and also to maintain the taste. That's why we also had our colleagues in Malawi Bureau of Standards, which is trying to certify. We have also assisted them with the equipment for them to measure the quality and the alcoholic content of the banana wine.
Vineyards that rely on stable climates are threatened by the unpredictability of climate change. So, could bananas replace grapes for winemaking? What is for sure now is that banana wine has proved a success in neighboring markets in Tanzania and Rwanda. But what about here in Malawi? Back at the farm, winemakers have a taste of their labor.
This is very sweet wine. You need to be seated to enjoy the flavors.
Adapting to climate change is a tough challenge for farmers around the world. But as the farming community in this part of Malawi can testify, there can be alternative solutions. As the say almost goes, if life gives you overripe bananas, make wine.
Anna Kumo reporting there on banana wine. You're listening to NewsHour from the BBC World Service. I'm Nuala McGovern on NewsHour. Well, 3 days of national mourning are beginning in Peru on Thursday for the former president, Alberto Fujimori, who has died at the age of 86. He's been called one of the most divisive figures in Peruvian politics. To some, he's a national hero who saved Peru. To others, an authoritarian leader with little regards for human rights or democratic institutions. Fujimori was released from prison last year after serving a long sentence for crimes against humanity and also for corruption. But whether imprisoned or free, his influence on the country continues to this day. Andrea Moncada is a Peruvian journalist and analyst at the Economist Intelligence Unit and explained how the country was grappling with his complex legacy.
The news is being received from a very divided perspective, I think. Alberto Fujimori, he's been quite central to Peruvian politics for the last 30-odd years. I mean, even after his regime ended in 2000, his legacy has always been a very key part of political discourse, mainly because his daughter, Keiko Fujimori, has been presidential candidate for the last three presidential elections. She's built a political party called Fuerza Popular on the back of her father's memory, and he still has many, many supporters who credit him for taking Peru out of an economic recession in the 90s, reducing hyperinflation. But at the same time, there's also a lot of detractors who see his passing as a bit of an end of a negative chapter for his history.
I came across the word Fujimorismo, which they talk about dominating Peruvian politics. What is it of her father, do you think, that Keiko continues to bring
to Peru?
I think it's essentially one main thing, which is the fact that when Alberto Fujimori won in 1990, he implemented a series of structural adjustment reform. He also, during his government, the leader of the Shining Path, a terrorist organization, left-wing terrorist organization, was waging a battle against the Peruvian state at the time, was captured in 1992. So he's credited for being quite tough on crime, on disorder. And that's also a message that she brings to Peruvian politics this day.
Tell us a little bit about Alberto Fujimori's life.
Fujimori, I think, would be the quintessential outsider in politics. You know, when he ran in 1990, he was very much an outsider, like an unknown figure. He had no connection to the political parties that dominated the political scene at that time. These parties were also largely discredited because Peru had been going through 10 years of hyperinflation in the 80s as well, and, you know, economic recessions and the war with the Shining Path. And so he presented himself as somebody who was untainted by the political clashes of the time and was a very popular figure. And I think his victory was seen as quite a positive thing at the time. And, you know, I think it was very quickly apparent that he was taking an authoritarian turn. 2 years into his presidency, he carried out what was called a self-coup. He dissolved Congress, called for new legislative elections and a constitutional assembly to create a new constitution. And he kept this authoritarian bent throughout his presidency. The lack of legitimacy among, you know, political parties is very much a legacy of Alberto Fujimori. He didn't really dedicate himself to party building. He was quite a populist president in the sense that for him, the most important thing was a direct relationship with the population without having to mediate through, you know, representative. And I think that is still a problem. That's a legacy that hasn't been resolved up to this day.
Is he the most divisive leader in Peru's history, would you say?
I would say so, yes. I think 100%. I can't think of any other Peruvian politician who's had such an impact, such a long-lasting impact, even, you know, years, decades after the end of his own presidency. You know, his memory is what has brought people to the streets time and time again throughout, you know, the last three presidencies, either to support him, but mainly to protest against his memory and protest against his daughter's attempt to bring back the power of Fujimorismo.
Andrea Moncada there from the Economist Intelligence Unit. Thanks very much to her. The head of American forces in Africa, General Michael Langley, has told the BBC that the US military will only cooperate with countries in the Sahel once they return to democracy. American and other Western forces have continued to withdraw from Burkina Faso, Mali, Chad, and more recently, Niger, as the leaders of these African countries pivot more towards Russia in their fight against expansionist jihadi forces. General Langley blamed the souring of relations, which resulted in the drawdown of troops, on a campaign of Russian disinformation. He was speaking in Nairobi to the BBC's Anne Soy, who began by asking him how the US military is now redefining its relationship with the Sahel.
When we define that, they have to have our core values. They have to have the core values of democratic norms, you know, and respect for human rights. All the things that are core values that are codified within a responsible governance for the people across civil society, protections of rights and freedoms.
You're saying that your re-engagement with the countries in the Sahel is premised on a return to democracy. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, yes. We are still engaged with them, but, you know, it's in a diplomatic vein right now as far as how much we can do, because, you know, there's a number of restrictions and sanctions with limits what we can do as far as security cooperation.
What you're saying generally is that you cannot exist side by side with some of these new partners that those countries have chosen.
They don't have the same values. There's ways
that we can still engage with that country itself. But no, we will not have side-by-side operations with them because they don't have the same values that we have, the law of armed conflict. That's just some of the things that, you know, watch groups are saying from when it was Wagner, that they're in true violation of that, allegedly.
When you look at Niger, for instance, you had huge investments there, Airbase 201, built at a cost of over $100 million. That's a major loss for you, isn't it?
Well, we look at it from a perspective. One, it's informed by the threat as far as our posture across West Africa. You do have a growing violent extremist organization threat, and it's metastasized across these countries that has affected Mali, that has affected Burkina Faso and Niger. So we look at it holistically, that we're still going to engage across West Africa with like-minded countries and some of the coastal West Africa countries to be able to help these countries defeat terrorism in that vein. Not just terrorism, but there's transnational crime organizations that are destabilizing as well.
And that's just the reason this military junta gave for asking your forces and the allied forces to leave, because they said despite being on the ground, the extremism continued to spread across the country. The jihadists continue to gain more territory. What's your assessment of the accomplishments of your forces when they were in the Sahelian region dealing with extremism?
And let me address some of the drivers of that instability. You know, back in 2008, across the Sahel or on the African continent, violent extremist organizations, especially Islamic extremism, was of the global percentage, 4%. Now it's 40%. Now these countries that don't have the security construct to defeat it, Russian disinformation primarily across the Sahel, gave them the scapegoat and said it was the West. So we're looking and listening. They say, hey, we don't want your boots on the ground. However, we do need some help in some areas. So across some of the domains that operationalize will help them build capacity to fight terrorism. But they also are coming at this problem set with a whole of government approach.
General Michael Langley is speaking to my colleague, the BBC's Anne Soy. I want to turn next to a development in technology that could help patients who have lost feeling in their hands and fingers through simulated sensations of touch with unrivaled sensitivity, that is, according to its researchers. It could also help this technology people who operate robotics for medical surgery and those that handle radioactive materials in nuclear decommissioning. It could make that also safer. So I spoke to Dr. Sarah Abbott. She is the lead researcher on this project at the University College London, and I asked Dr. Sarah to explain exactly what the new technology is designed to do.
The new technology that we have developed is bio-inspired on the human sense of touch. So we look into how we interact with our world, which is basically our skin. And in our skin, we have four main receptors, which are mainly associated with touch. Each one of them provides a different type of information. For instance, it gives us the type of texture of the object that we are interacting with, the type of stimulus, or what is the direction of the stimulus as well. Something important about this system is that because it is an interface that is covering the whole finger, so we can provide a stimulus across the whole finger, so it's more realistic as well in that sense.
So if somebody has low sensitivity in their fingers, what can they expect if they use your technology?
So what we're trying to do with this system is we're trying to measure how much the person has lost touch. Depending on how much you have lost, we can quantify this, and also we can measure it periodically so we can study how it is evolving over time.
How do you see this being used in day-to-day life for people?
It has so many applications. So for instance, it can be applied in the social context. Nowadays, we do several video calls every day. But unfortunately, the difference between a face-to-face interaction is we develop social bonding due to the sense of touch. And that's why if we provide that information using our fingertip interface to the video calls, we want to enhance those video calls and we would like to promote to see how it can enhance the social bonding.
Tell me how you would use your technology. Say I have a video call with my mother, for example. How might you increase the sense of touch between us if we're looking at each other on a screen?
So what we will do is we will embed our interface in a glove.
In a glove, so, yeah.
Yes, so both your mom and yourself will be wearing this glove, so you will be able to, when you are interacting, you will receive the information, the stimulus, straight to your fingers.
I love the idea of that. We could have done with that during the pandemic. But does something like that not exist already in video games, for example? I'm also thinking VR applications.
Exist, but it is limited. So we need to be trained in order to understand, okay, this type of stimulus means that I'm receiving a strong stimulus. While when we are interacting with our own fingers, we don't need to do that because our brain is already doing that mapping. I mean, our vision is in the future that the technology stimulates these receptors that we have in the skin. So the brain receives that information and processes it like if it is interacting with a real object.
A whole brand new world of technology. I like that idea of the gloves. Dr. Sara Abad, lead researcher on the project at University College London. Thanks very much to her. You are listening to NewsHour from the BBC World Service. This is Nuala McGovern with NewsHour live from the BBC in London. The war photographer Lee Miller is played by Kate Winslet, who also produced the new film that is out. It's called Lee, and it's about part of Lee Miller's life. She was a Vogue model, also a muse and lover of the surrealist artist Man Ray in her younger years. She also became a trailblazing photographer during the Second World War, making it to the front line and defying expectations of her sex. Lee Miller captured harrowing and important images while at the liberation of Buchenwald and Dachau concentration camps. She was also famously photographed in Hitler's bathtub at his apartment in Munich after his death. Miss Miller died in 1977, and the new film is based on the lives of Lee Miller, a book by Anthony Penrose, her only child from her marriage to the surrealist artist Roland Penrose. He worked closely with Kate Winslet on this film and granted full access to his mother's personal archives and diaries.
Only a woman could have taken these.
Thank you.
Audrey, listen to me. When the time comes, send me to Europe.
The ministry's been very clear that when the time comes, our duty will be to
do our bit. Yes, yes, yes. I know. But why should the men get to decide what that is? Why can't women go to the front line? Why?
As much as I admire your tenacity, and I do, Lee, it wouldn't work. You wouldn't be able to get anything back to us without military sanction. It's just fruitless. I'm sorry.
Ask again.
My colleague Emma Barnett spoke to Kate Winslet and began by asking her what drove her to dedicate almost 10 years of her life to Lee Miller.
The reason I wanted to make the film was because I wanted to lift her out of the male gaze. You know, when I first started Googling Lee Miller, I knew a bit about her, sure. I had a couple of books about her. I had books that included photographs of her as a model. But I did not know this Lee. I really didn't. And when I first Googled her in 2015, the first thing that comes up is, and you said the words yourself, former muse of Man Ray, ex-model, Vogue cover girl, these labels, you know, and we do like to label women. But these labels that existed even then, and they exist for women still now, which does drive me mad because we don't use those labels for men. But Lee was described in a sort of almost infantilizing way. And I thought, hang on a minute, hang on. That was a sliver of her life in her 20s. She lived a whole life way beyond that time. And she hated being a model. She always said, I'd rather take a picture than be one. And
it's quite a journey, isn't it, to go from, you know, being the subject in that way to, you know, what she ended up photographing, the liberation of Buchenwald and Dachau, you know, the front lines of the absolute most, you know, unimaginable horrors of World War II.
Yeah. And I'm sure she didn't know what to expect. I don't think she was naive. I think Lee Miller was born with her eyes wide open. who of any of us, of anyone who witnessed the atrocities of the Nazi regime, who could ever have known what they were to be met with when they walked through the gates of Dachau or Auschwitz? Who could possibly have known? But what Lee did do that sets her photography apart was not to photograph the soldiers and the bloodshed and the actual fighting. She didn't do that. Other war correspondents were sent there to do exactly that job. But Lee was in a position where she could follow her nose, and she'd spent her life being extremely good at that and being very instinctive and also being extremely restless. And she talked about that, you know, oh, I'd stay here much longer if it weren't for my damn itchy bottom, she would say. And that's how she would describe this sort of restlessness in her that even she herself couldn't really understand. She was unique because when you use a Rolleiflex camera, and of course I had to learn how to use one myself quite well, the Rolleiflex camera, for listeners who don't know, it is not a camera that you hold up to the eye. There is a facility that you can do that, but it's a square, rather heavy camera. And actually, typically, a Rolleiflex photograph is taken from just between the heart and the stomach, is where it sits on the body. And you look down into the camera at the image, at the person or object or scenario that you are photographing. But what that means is that once the light meter has been read, the settings are in place, the focus is perfect, it means that Lee can then look into the eyes of the person she's photographing. She can observe the situation. She can really step into the same world as that person to really immerse herself in what she was documenting.
One of the photos that is very famous of her at this time, as opposed to when she was a model, I just wanted to understand from you how you read into it, how you spoke about it with her son, which is her decision to get into Hitler's bathtub and be photographed. What's going on there?
Listen, at that stage of things, they had not changed their clothes for 6 weeks. This is true. They hadn't changed their clothes for 6 weeks and they hadn't touched hot water for 6 weeks. Okay, so they walked into the gates of Dachau and they were there to bear witness, which they did. And then from there, they drove to Munich. Lee knew where Hitler's Munich apartment was, a bit like Downing Street. People know where it is. So she drove to Prinzregentenplatz, which is the address where his apartment is. And there was a guy on the door keeping guard, and Lee, using her wiles, would have bribed him with a carton of cigarettes or half a bottle of brandy. She was very, very good at finding the things that she really needed to keep her going. And she made her way in. And it's true that when they got into the apartment, there was an entire regiment in there having a party. And then they discovered there was a bathroom. And there are many photographs of other people using that bathroom, you know, soldiers, GIs having a shave. I myself can perfectly well see how, as a woman in that situation where she hadn't had any clean knickers for 6 weeks, can you imagine turning that tap on and going, oh, it's hot water? So I think there was something in her that just thought, well, it would be logical to take a bath. And we decided that once she was in that bar, then she realized this is a photograph that no one else is going to get or even think of or even dare to take. But Lee had that in her. She was a risk taker. She saw things and did things her way. And I've just never come across anyone like her.
That was the actor Kate Winslet speaking to my colleague Emma Barnett on the BBC about her new film Lee, which is about the photographer Lee Miller. You're listening to NewsHour.
I'm Sumi Somaskandar from the Global Story Podcast, where we're looking at the U.S. presidential debate, which much of the world was watching. Kamala Harris went up against Donald Trump in Philadelphia in the first face-off between the two ahead of November's election. What were the key takeaways?
The Global Story brings you unique perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.